Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So, thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on the Sydney Opera House with Anne Watson and Michael Bohm. I'll introduce both of them briefly. Michael is going to talk second, but he is the author of The Sydney Opera House Affair, which was published around half a century ago. Michael's well known to many of you. He was he worked in the Australian Financial Review and then in the Bulletin. For the Bulletin, it was at for the Bulletin at the time when Peter Coleman was editor, and Peter's here tonight, that Michael wrote this article in the Bulletin that became this book. He joined the House of Representatives as a Liberal Party member in 1975. He was defeated later on and returned as a senator in 1984.
Involuntary retirement.
And then he was a parliamentary secretary for the Treasurer during the period of the Howard government, and then became Australia's Consul General in New York, and has since been writing in various places, including The Spectator and other places. Dr. Anne Watson is an architecture and design curator and writer. Her 2004 University of Sydney PhD thesis examined Peter Hall and his team's work on the Opera House between 1966 and 1970. And Anne is the author of The Poison Cellist, Peter Hall and the Sydney Opera House, and we've got copies of that book to sell at the end of proceedings. And so on the topic of Peter Hall and the Sydney Opera House, let's hear from Anne Watson and then from Michael Bohm, then we'll take questions and discussion. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. I've just had a quite traumatic trip in from the northern beaches, so my apologies for arriving a bit late. Okay, to start with, this is a very complex story, as you can imagine, and you might be asking how on earth I got myself involved in something as controversial, I guess, as the history of the Opera House after Utzon. It started in about 2004 when I was a curator at the Powerhouse Museum, and I started work on an exhibition to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the competition, which would have occurred in 2006. That exhibition never happened for various reasons, most of them budgetary, but I did end up editing a catalogue, book of essays, which you can see up here, Building a Masterpiece, the Sydney Opera House. It virtually dealt with the Utzon years, didn't really pay any attention to what happened after Utzon left in 1966, for which I'm quite sad, but in 2013 it was produced in a second edition and I was able to write a new chapter on Peter Hall's work, so that kind of updated it. But at the end of that project, just as the book was being published, I was contacted by Willie Hall, Peter Hall's son, and he invited me down to his farm in Mittagong to look at his father's papers. And that was a real sort of turning point for me, because the photographs, the diaries, the correspondence, masses of material, just told a very different story about the circumstances when Utzon resigned in early 1966 and the changes that were made to the building brief and why they were made. So it's been a very long journey for me. I subsequently started a PhD at Sydney University in 2008 and focused on the Peter Hall years. So that was turned into a book, which is available tonight, which I hope some of you will buy, if not all of you. That would be great. And just before I go on, I want to thank all the members of the Opus SOH, Inc., group that was formed several years ago to get behind the publication of the book. And they've basically raised the funds to publish. So, you know, really, I owe it all to them. And John Rourke is, and Michael are members of that group. Okay, Peter Hall. He loved his cars, as you can see, very early photograph from his archive, and a much later one in the taken in the early 1970s of Peter in his convertible Jaguar. But I've put it in, and you can't actually see it. But just behind him is a road sign saying "steep decline." And although, of course, he's heading in the other direction, so he can't see it. But I like to think that this photograph, taken really when the worst of the Opera House was over, but just before it opened, is kind of symbolic of you know, his life after the Opera House. But we'll get to that a bit later. Peter was born in 1931 in Newcastle. He was brought up in Narrabri in the country. He scholastically did very, very well, won numerous scholarships, one to Cranbrook, where he went as a boarder. Then he won scholarships to Sydney University, where he studied architecture and the classics, did a double degree. And he did that under a government architect's branch bursary, which is, you know, something that they had then that they no longer have. People like Ken Woolley, Michael Dysart, some very well-known architects, went through university on this very generous scheme, and Peter very much benefited from it. Just after he graduated in 1957, he won a very prestigious travelling scholarship, which enabled him to travel, study design and architecture. He went with his wife Libby, and basically that those were the years, the end of the 50s, that he did that travel. So, oh, hang on, I'll just go back. One of his he kept diaries about where he went, and he also took a lot of photographs. He's photographed right throughout his life and kept most of them as slides. So it's a fantastic record of his life before the Opera House, and of course during and after the Opera House as well. And I'm happy to say that a lot of that material is currently being assessed by the State Library, so they'll acquire it, or a lot of it, down the track. The Cassell documenter is, or still is, and was then a major contemporary art exhibition held annually, I think. He took lots of photographs of that, was very impressed with the design of the exhibition and the layout and the contents, etc. He visited Kew Gardens and loved the glasshouse, designed in the 1840s, but, you know, a real landmark of design and engineering skills in those days. And it was this building, the Kew Glasshouse, that was to inspire him when problems arose designing the northern glass walls of the Opera House in the late 1960s. He spent quite a bit of time in Greece, particularly in Mykonos, with his wife Libby, photographing all the time, but also producing these very beautiful little sketches, apparently for sale to tourists, but a lot of them were kept, and again, they're in his archive. He returned to Sydney in 1959 and went straight to work in the government architect's office. In those days, Ted Farmer was the government architect, and it coincided with a very creative time in the office. As I said, Ken Woolley was there, Michael Dysart, Andrew Adnison's was soon to start. And one of the, apart from working on Macquarie University Library, which of course was then just being built, Hall designed Goldstein Hall Residential College at the University of New South Wales, took photographs of it. It subsequently won the very prestigious Sulman Award, one of the RAIA medals, and survived, I think the dining hall, The dining hall still survives intact, I think. Last time I went there about 3 years ago, it was all still there, to from the light fittings to the refectory style furniture, all of which Hall designed. So it's very much, you know, a kind of hangover, if you like. Very interesting sort of heritage example from the mid-1960s, of mid-1960s design. Sadly, the residential colleges haven't survived, and that whole residential area of the University of New South Wales has been rebuilt fairly recently. So this was, as I said, a very prestigious award, and really established Hall's reputation in the architectural community in Sydney. And I think, really, if it wasn't for this building, this project, that it's unlikely that Ted Farmer, the government architect, would have actually invited Hall to take on the very onerous task of following Utzon's footsteps. So as well as designing buildings in the government architect's office, they were in those days able to take on private jobs. One of those was the design of the Marion Hall Best shop in Woollahra, and I don't know if any of you saw the Marion Hall Best exhibition downstairs in the Museum of Sydney. It's a fabulous exhibition. And that photograph was in it, and there was quite a bit about Hall and his contribution. Okay, so that takes us up to late 1965. I don't know if people can read that. There were, as I'm sure most of you know, a lot of problems. But over the years, they've really been simplified. And I think one of the revelations for me when I was doing the research on my thesis was just how sort of complicated that whole logjam of problems was, and very, very messy. Why Hall took it on, I don't know, but I can only imagine that he and his colleagues just weren't fully aware of all the problems that had accumulated. We all know about the escalating time and budget costs, but you probably don't know that Utzon was not getting on very well with the engineers, Ovara, engineering company, at the time, to the point where they were hardly speaking to each other. So things were pretty dire. There was a new state government. They were determined to rein in costs, to get the building finished. So it became a bit of a political football as well. One of the biggest problems was that Utzon had been working on a dual-purpose main hall. It was then called the Major Hall, so it was to be for concerts and for opera. Now, when you have concerts and opera in the one space, you have two very different performance types. One, opera, requires a stage and a proscenium, a certain kind of seating, while concerts don't need a stage and a proscenium, but they do need a platform. And they each need very different acoustics. When you have the two together, you're going to have compromised acoustics. This was a huge problem because the ABC, which then managed the Sydney Symphony, were going to be the main users of the main hall. And they were insisting on 2,800 seats, or they wouldn't move out of the town hall. So there was this terrible sort of bargaining going on. Utzon got caught in the middle of it, and Hall would, you know, inherit that very difficult situation. So Utzon resigned on the 28th of February 1966, and we all know what a terrible mess things turned into then. There were protests. It was a very difficult situation. The government tried to come up with a compromise strategy, but Utzon was really unprepared to accept that. So he left the country, and just a few more protest posters, which I acquired when I was at the Powerhouse about 10 years ago. And that's what the building looked like when Utzon resigned. So the shells are sort of half up, but you know, obviously there's no interior work going on. And in fact, the designs that Utzon left when he resigned, the designs that he left for the interiors were very unresolved for various reasons. On the left is a sectional model of the main hall that represents Utzon's final design for that particular space. And you can see it actually shows on the stage a performer that it's set up for a performance of Tosca. And so it's obviously a dual-purpose opera concert hall. The Utzonites promoted this this model and the designs that went with it as indicating that Utzon's designs at the time of his departure were very well resolved, that, you know, basically it was all just ready to go. This wasn't the case at all, as Hall and his colleagues were about to find out. And this little model is very interesting because a lot of the Utzonites at the time accused the government of hiding the model, that is, taking it away because it ostensibly showed that Utzon's designs were all kind of ready to go. But in fact, I found out during the course of my research, a lot of which was at State Records, out in Kingswood, about an hour out of Sydney, discovered all this these files that suggest a very different story. And in fact, this model and the one on the right that shows Joan Sutherland were produced, they were actually commissioned by the federal government, and they were produced to be sent to various embassies and, you know, promotions, trade fairs to promote Australia overseas. So in fact, the little model, the sectional model, was taken away to be shown in a trade fair in Tokyo in April 1966. It was never hidden away. The model with Joan Sutherland was shown at the San Francisco Opera House, and there she is standing with it, and it seems to have since disappeared. So it just really indicates that, you know, the stories that are have been perpetuated in a lot of the publications, essays and books don't necessarily stand up to scrutiny when, you know, you really delve into the research. And I found this time and time again in the course of my work. So various architects were approached by Ted Farmer, the government architect. Most of them knocked back the invitation to take over the role of design architect after Utzon left. Hall took it on, and he worked with two architects who he actually never met before. They'd never all worked together, so they were really starting from scratch, and that was Lionel Todd on the left and David Littlemore in the middle, who is the father of Stuart Littlemore. And they basically had to figure out how they were going to proceed. So one of the biggest surprises was when they first looked at the Utzon drawings in May 66 and discovered that they were very unresolved, that there were not enough seats, that the seats were too narrow, that the acoustics weren't resolved, that the plywood ceilings that Utzon had wanted that you see in the sectional model, the engineers were saying that they were too heavy, that it wouldn't work. So, you know, they had a very emotional, if you like, wake-up call. Hall then decided that he would have to go on a very steep learning curve, so went on a three-month study trip from the 20th of June that took him Europe, America, UK and Japan, and the whole intention was to study performance spaces, to meet consultants and to get the best advice to proceed, to make the changes that were necessary to proceed with the building. So he took lots of photographs, did lots of drawings. The one on the left is a profile of the steps on the Boston Public Library. And his archive has several travel books full of these drawings and lots of photographs, so it's all very well documented. In Europe, he visited two of the acoustic consultants who'd been working with Utzon, Wilhelm Jordan, who was from Denmark, and Krömer and Gabler, who were German, where they were from Berlin. And you can see Peter Hall, he's on the right there, and next to him on his right is Wilhelm Jordan. He also visited Japan, and this was his first trip to Japan. Took lots of photographs. I said he loved cars, and I think that little MG in the front of the the building is possibly one that he maybe borrowed from friends in Tokyo. But this is the superb Kenzo Tange Olympic Gymnasium that was built for the 1964 Tokyo Olympics. And Paul, as you can imagine, was really bowled over by this and saw a lot of affinities with the Opera House in terms of its very innovative design and the problems that were encountered building it. But one of the buildings that was very influential was this one. It's the Saitama Concert Hall that was just finished as he arrived in Tokyo. And what he admired was the curved plywood ceiling in the concert hall. You can see that on the right, and he drew it in one of his travel diaries. And he was later to reference this design for the curved plywood ceiling of the concert hall, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Okay, so Hall got back to Sydney in mid-September. He'd met so many consultants and learnt so much, and decided that the only course was to revise the brief for the building. This was released just before Christmas in 1966. It was called the Review of Programme. The biggest change was that the main hall was to no longer be dual purpose, but was to be for concerts only, and that it was to seat 2,800 as required by the ABC. Opera was relocated to the Drama Theatre, which hadn't been designed for opera at all. And we all know the problems with the Opera Theatre, and, you know, all my research indicates that they very well knew them then, you know, that the small, very small pit, the lack of wing space, the small stage. They were required to fit 1,500 seats into a theatre that had been designed basically for drama for 1,200 people. So it was a huge, you know, a very big ask, I guess, to turn the project around and enable it to move forward. And for 3 months, the debate, argument went on in the media until finally in... the end of March 1967, Davis Hughes, the Minister for Works, decreed that basically the recommendations in the review would go ahead. So by early 1967, things were sort of starting to move in a very slow way. One of the misconceptions about Hall and his team was that they just immediately rejected all of Utzon's designs, that, you know, basically to move forward, you know, they had to completely redesign the building from scratch. This wasn't the case at all. They did try to respect Utzon's designs, and there's lots of references to that in the research. And I don't want to get too technical, but this is the first design for the concert hall. They decided to abandon plywood on the advice of the engineers because it was considered to be just too innovative, too experimental, and too difficult. Came up with an idea for a catenary system, that's a sort of looped arches in concrete. Down the bottom is the 1 to 10 acoustic model that was built that shows this scheme, and as you can see, it's pretty awful. And Hall agreed that it was pretty awful. The problem was that in Utzon's scheme, and I've just showed that on the right, the early 66 scheme, the swoops of the ceiling ended in a proscenium arch, and with the hall now just devoted totally to concerts, that proscenium arch was no longer required. So the next design, I'll just go through these quickly, developed in early 1968, moved the concert platform further into the centre of the space and then surrounded the platform with seating, much as it is now, but the ceiling, as you can see, is very different. And then in late 1968, the final scheme was generated that used the sort of radial ceiling idea over the orchestra platform. And this crown piece, from which all the plywood emanated, if you like, also reflected the height of the arch above. So this was the highest arch in the building. The Opera Theatre was very, very difficult, as I've said, and I've just put this little sketch in. It's probably a bit hard to see because it's in state records and it's about this big and it's laminated, and they wouldn't take it out of the lamination, so I just had to photograph it as it was. But it's very cute. It's drawn by Peter Hall, and it says, "Are the acoustics any good in here? Pardon," that's the two speech bubbles. So that kind of says it all. It's nice to know that they kept their sense of humour. I think there were long sessions at the pub at the end of the day. So the Opera Theatre, and I've talked about the problems with it, went through various design incarnations during 1968, but some interesting material that I found in one of the archives out at State Records was a correspondence and trade catalogues relating to the intention to clad the concrete boxes along the side of the Opera Theatre with this stuff called metal flake, so they, you know, would have glittered in the dark, and they were going to have uplights, and it was a kind of a cute idea that was abandoned. But the intention was to kind of enliven the space a bit, much as traditional opera theatres often have a very rich red and gold theme. In the end, they went for the John Coburn tapestry, which I think is a great shame that it's no longer there. Apparently, the Opera House are going to get it out and use it somewhere, but as far as I know, it's been in storage for quite a long time and is probably going to stay there for a while. The seating, you're probably not aware when you sit in the Opera House. You probably are aware that you have to squeeze past people to get to your seat. That wasn't the architect's fault. Basically, it was the ABC's fault because, you know, they made this requirement of seating numbers that was really a bit unrealistic for the space that was available. There were numerous files in state records dealing with the design of the seating, and it was actually very interesting. I've written a paper on it that you can access online. Basically, you know, we had to look smart, in sympathy with the building and the interiors. It had to have a tilt mechanism that was very quiet. It had to be comfortable, and it had to be affordable. After about 3 years, they finally came up with... Oh, this is Diana Luxton, who some of us know. Back in 1968, she looks a bit different now, but she's a wonderful person. She was Hall's interior designer, so she was responsible for coordinating the design of the seating and also the interior colour schemes. These colour charts I came across in a letter from... Diana to one of the fabric suppliers, and I've just put them in there because it shows you know, how sort of bright and colourful they envisaged the interiors at the time. And you have to bear in mind that this was the late 60s, so, you know, anything was on the table. And then finally, in late 1971, the chair was launched to great fanfare. There was a front page photograph in the Sydney Morning Herald. And I think the seating's been very successful. One thing a lot of people don't realise is that the seats were designed so that if you're sitting at the end of a row and you've arrived a bit earlier than the people sitting in the middle, the edge of the front of the seat, when it tilts up, is designed so you can sort of perch on it to allow people to get past. I've not seen anyone use this, but that was a kind of deliberate way of providing a bit more room for access to the middle of the rows. The northern glass walls. I'm not going to go into too much detail because I'm going over time, I'm sure. Very, very complicated. The hardest part of the building to design caused a lot of conflict with between the architects and the engineers, mostly to do with the corners of the glass walls. These are just some schemes up the top and on the left. So there's that sectional model again. This is the first scheme. And you can see in the second scheme, it's lost that canopy that went over the foyer. The architects were instructed by the government to actually make the Utzon design their starting point. So the model on the right was designed in the Hall Todd and Littlemore office and follows the scheme on the left. But as you can see, that at the end there, they just haven't sorted out how to design it, and that was to be a huge problem. And my chapter in The Poison Chalice on the Northern Glass Walls is called Contentious Corners, and indeed they were. Like Utzon, the Hall Todd and Littlemore team, Peter Hall in particular, worked a lot with models trying to solve these fairly unique problems. And it was really, you know, the only way that they could work through and resolve, you know, how to build these very difficult glass walls. Huge, very exposed to the weather, to winds, and very complex at the corner ends where the platform and the steps sort of meet the foyer area. This is a photograph of Hall on the right, appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald, and apparently he was wearing a tangerine bow tie, and he's also got a sort of striped jacket on, but he does look rather tired, I think, and things were getting a little bit difficult by this stage. And finally, in during the late 69, there was some progress, and they, how can I explain this very simply? Jim Anderson's here, who worked on the glass walls. Basically, they discovered or generated a new geometry for the glass walls. It had it in three stages, with the third stage fanning out over the foyer. The problem with Utzon's design was that he had the very deep plywood mullions coming right down to the edge of the platform, which impeded views out to the harbour but also cut into the space available in the foyer. So a way of overcoming this, that was this kind of fanning out. But, of course, what it meant was that the corner areas stuck out a little. Something that Utzon would have not wanted, but really was unavoidable at the time. And really the only way to resolve this kind of impasse between the architects and the engineers and the need for space and for views, etc. And I've grown used to it. I really like the design now, and it's very much of its era. And those glass walls won several awards for their technological innovation at the time. So people don't know that Peter Hall was called back to work on the forecourt and the concourse in the 1980s with the government architect. He wasn't the government architect, but Andrew Andersons, who worked in the government architect's office. And then I've just put this little, this is in his archive, it's this little drawing, it's about this big. I'm not sure who drew it, but I date it to the late 1970s when Hall was, so well after the Opera House, Hall was working as Director of Architecture for the Department of Federal Department of Housing and Construction in Canberra. And somewhere it says balancing, world-famous tightrope act. Sorry. But what it does indicate is just what an incredible balancing act his role was between his respect for Utzon as the original architect of the building and, you know, the demands of the government, the engineers, the consultants, time, budget, all of that. So it was very difficult. I think he did a brilliant job, was not recognised, and died pretty much in straitened circumstances in 1995 at the age of 64, really. And things are starting to change now, which is fantastic, and I'm very gratified that that's happening, but, you know, it's very slow. And what I never wanted to happen was that Peter Hall sort of be turned into this kind of mythical genius like Utzon has been. So I hope it doesn't go too far the other way. I don't think it will.
Thanks, Anne.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know it started with Jared, but it's me here now because Jared had to buzz off to another function. So if you sit down, Anne, we're going to hear from Michael. Is that right? Michael, yeah. Bohm's got a few comments to make.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Anne Squared. This Anne's book is a remarkable manifestation of the truth that in order to praise Utzon, you don't have to accept the conventional wisdom of vilifying Hall and erasing him from the history of the Sydney Opera House. All the key participants, Utzon, Hall and Ovarup, all deserve their share of recognition. Until this book, Hall has been disgracefully excluded from the altar of Utzon worship. My involvement here follows Anne's revelation that my book, published more than 50 years ago, and by the way, my book is about the Utzon period and Anne's is about the post-Utzon period, her revelation was that the departure of Utzon from the Sydney Opera House was a key factor, my book was a key factor in the breakdown of negotiations to get Utzon to return to finish his opera house, which he never saw as a completed building. Apart from the evident fact that so much information damaging to Utzon in my book, fact-checked by Hall, by the way, as stated in the introduction, clearly came from either the project structural engineers, Ovarup and Partners, or the New South Wales government. Utzon was especially upset by a chapter in my book written by Peter Hall entitled Function is Not a Dirty Word, an obvious slap at those whose only concern was form. Of specific concern to Utzon was that Hall's chapter included a drawing of his idea to make comprehensive changes in the nature of the interior of the main hall. Hall had justified this by writing correctly that the requirements of the Opera House's major user were not being met in Utzon's concept, as indicated in, and I quote, drawings showing a good deal of design intent, but were not working drawings, that Utzon left. Utzon's angry and, in reality, hyperbole in response was that these changes would, and I quote, would destroy completely the architecture of the Opera House, a cry repeated ad absurdum by Utzon acolytes. Because my book, written when the sales were still under construction and completion was still 7 years away, did not spring to Utzon's defence along the lines of the then trendy view of the genius versus the goths, but rather concluded in what Anne graciously acknowledges as an incisive summation, that this is not a story of goodies and baddies. It's a story of bad decisions made for good reasons, of good intentions that went wrong, of personal tensions that built up to a point that made it impossible for the project to go on as it was, of an artist who, for many reasons, including a great deal that were not his fault, made a mess of things. But I dared to say that the available evidence prompts a very real criticism of the architect's handling of the project. But not all the evidence could be printed in my book. Having been subject not only to legal threats from Jurnitsen, but also objections from senior members of Ovarpen Partners, the engineering firm responsible for bringing Jurnitsen's sketched concept to a strikingly different reality, but who apparently did not want to be blamed for publicly undermining Jurnitsen. By the way, a recent biography of Ove Arup provides evidence that overwhelmingly endorses my stance. For the reality is that Utzon days were numbered when he and Arup's fell out, as Anne has indicated. Because Utzon had never built a major structure, the New South Wales government accepted the advice of the adjudicators of the design competition that Utzon won to appoint the engineers as the principal contractor, not, as is customary, the architect. For years, Arup and Utzon, and I say this, provocatively, for years, Arup and Utzon effectively conspired to conceal from the New South Wales government and its incompetent committee that acted as the client the reality of open-ended costs, that this building was not going to be a traditional one with steel frame from which cladding would be attached, but would be self-supporting concrete shelves. This had never been done before and still hasn't. The Opera House sails are not 6-inch thick shelves, but 6 feet thick, massive arches. After years of Arup's unsuccessful attempts to build its and sketches, which almost sent Arup's broke and caused division and resignations at high level within the firm, followed by more years of protecting Utzon from governmental concerns about rising costs, delays and lack of progress with working drawings, eventually Arup's called time. That falling out, manifested, by the way, by Utzon bricking up the connecting door between their on-site offices, meant the end of Utzon, with the only difference between a Labor and a coalition government being the manner and timing of his departure. Back in 1967, my book was subjected to a cacophony of attacks from those who, like Harry Seidler, decreed that by getting rid of Utzon, the New South Wales government had destroyed the Opera House. Despite Harry and the vicious campaign against Hall, the building that Hall and his team completed was not destroyed. On the contrary, it is acknowledged as one of the greatest of the 20th century, with Hall being awarded international architectural honours. But in Australia, Utzon worship and Hall denigration has meant that the Hall team has never been given the credit that is their due. At the Opera House Trust's 40th anniversary of the Opera House's opening, the only hero was Utzon. Attacks on my book included an accusation that I had a bias against Utzon, which, by the way, is repeated in Anne's otherwise excellent book. I certainly held no political bias. If anything, at that stage of my life, I had a far closer relationship with Premier Jack Renshaw's Labor government. I had inside knowledge that Premier Renshaw wanted the excessively costly, long-standing Opera House running sore fixed, even if it meant Utzon's departure. The incoming coalition state government acted on the Renshaw government's demands for working drawings or else no payments. Subsequent promises by Renshaw's public works minister, Ryan, to restore Utzon if Labor could be returned to power were in stark contrast to his threats to Utzon when minister. If I had any bias, it was not before, but after my undertaking volumes of research, when I came to the view that I was more concerned about the future of the Opera House than I was about the future of Utzon. How fortunate that, as shown in Anne's book, Utzon's sketchy plans and indications of intentions were so dramatically changed by Peter Hall and his team so as to bring about the conversion of Utzon's beautiful sculpture into a workable building that went a lot further towards achieving the clearly stated requirements of the competition that Utzon was unable to meet. The distinguished architect Andrew Andersons, when launching Anne's book in the northern foyer of the Opera House under Hall's magnificent glass wall, said that while he was perpetually thankful for Utzon's vision, he was also grateful for Peter Hall, to Peter Hall and his talented team of collaborators and consultants that gave us this masterpiece of 20th century architecture. Anne's book should shame those whose unyielding animus towards Peter Hall drove him to despair and early death. If Anne's book leads to a belated proper acknowledgement of the role Hall and his team played in Australia's greatest building, it'll be too late for Peter Hall, but not too late for posterity.
Okay, well, thanks, Michael. We haven't got a lot of time for questions. Anyone wishing to ask? All right, Andrew, who do you want to ask the question of?
The author, Anne.
Anne, come forward. Anne, you can stay here. Just stay here, Anne.
The book that came out a few years ago, The Masterpiece. Are you familiar with that book?
Philip Drew's book.
Yeah, that's it. How does that treat the topic of Peter Hall, the...
It treats Whitson in an extraordinarily heroic way and demolishes Hall, basically. But interestingly, just to add to that, Philip Drew has changed his tune in recent years and, in fact, has written about the Opera House and about Utzon in a much more critical way and more supportive of Hall. So he's sort of come around to see that while it's a magnificent building, the fact that Utzon's design was basically a concept, it was unbuildable, the competition scheme, and that raised the succession of problems that first Utzon and then Hall encountered. So, even he's kind of changed his tune recently, which is a good thing.
Yes?
And you mentioned that the models that you showed us have disappeared. I find that very strange. Can you add anything to that?
Well, you're talking about the Utzon models? Mm. Yes, only one of them has disappeared. The full model that I showed a photograph of with Joan Sutherland, I've not been able to find that anywhere. The sectional model is in the Powerhouse collection. So that survived. There's an earlier sectional model that looks similar to that one, but in fact shows a different ceiling design by Utzon. And that was completed in 64. But sadly, all those little models that I showed you of the glass wall, you know, the various iterations of the glass walls, they were all destroyed. And so were the acoustic models, which is a great shame. Yeah.
Hello.
Yes,
question over here. Reynold.
I have a question. The Opera House is a beautiful building and, of course, put Sydney on the map of the world, but is it a good opera house?
Is it a good opera house?
Oh, I'd have to say no.
Why is that?
No, well, for, you know, all the reasons that I've said, it was basically designed from the outside in. You cannot design a building of that complexity, particularly one that encloses performing arts spaces like that. You know, you've got to design your interiors, get your seating right, get your ceiling right, get your acoustics as right as you can, and then basically, you know, design the shell. And that's, it happened the other way. So all those problems, the acoustic problems, the problems of the, you know, the stage constraints and the orchestra pit constraints in the opera theatre, they all resulted from the fact that the building program changed over time. Part of the problem was that the foundations were started in 1959 under pressure from Joe Carl, who was then the premier. Before they'd even solved the problem of the geometry for the shells, and of course, once that changed, they had to change the foundations, and then they had to change the interiors, and then it's very difficult. But having said that, I love the concert hall. I think it's a beautiful space, very, very beautiful space, and works brilliantly. The acoustics were good in their time. It seemed fit that they're going to be improved, so that's a good thing. Let's hope they don't modify Peter Hall and his team's design too much. The Opera Theatre you know, it's gorgeous to go there, but, you know, there are problems.
Could I add add a bit, if I may, as former federal shadow minister for the arts. When you have a shape like that, where do you put wings? I mean, whatever was going to happen, even if it was in the big hall, there was still an absence of wing space, and massive machinery was required to change set. It was alleged that it would take 6 hours to produce some of the major operas because of the shift change, scene changing involved. But in defence, here's me, I'll wash my mouth out after this, in defence of Joe Carl and his Labor government, he had to, for political reasons, he had to start work immediately on that building if it was going to go ahead.
And it wouldn't have happened, basically, would it?
It simply would not have happened. The pressure within his own party about the shortage of funds for housing at the time was overwhelming. And it was Joe Carl, maybe he was got at by some of the people involved, particularly Mrs. C.T. Lorenz, who wanted it as an opera house when the ABC was demanding it be a concert hall. And Utzon would tend to side on whoever he was actually supporting his position. That's why the committee was a disaster. But the opera house was never going to be an opera house. The priority in the contract and in the competition, the priorities were clearly listed. Concert hall number one, and any subsequent uses would be behind that first objective. And I'm afraid it was never going to be an opera house. It was always, the first priority was a concert hall.
Okay.
Well, that really answers the question I was going to ask. The question was, is it a good opera house? And clearly, what you've just said is, that's that space over there. Mm. What we're building is the concert hall, and it really should be called the Sydney Concert
Yes.
Hall.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, we need an opera house.
Down
the back.
Now,
Utzon
did go on to do very clever buildings, the Kuwait Parliament. He did win the highest architectural awards in the world, the Pritzker Prize, the Opera Alto Prize. He did these buildings on time and on budget. Do we really think, are just these claims that it was unbuildable and it was just sketchy? He's proved himself in complicated work later and heralded around the world. Do you really think how can you say that he just didn't have the capacity to finish?
No, I'm not saying he didn't have the capacity. I'm saying that the competition drawings, which are now housed in state records, are very, very sketchy. And those curves...
It
was an architectural competition that also had to meet the brief of the competition. And it didn't supply enough details for that.
It was about £3 million it was supposed to be shortfall, wasn't it? Or was it £4 million? Something like that.
2.5 million or something.
2.5 million.
Yeah.
I don't want to denigrate. You know, Utzon, I've met his family. I haven't met Utzon, but I've been in touch with him. He wrote a beautiful introduction for my first book when I was at the Powerhouse. He's a brilliant architect. It was a brilliant idea, you know. He worked incredibly well with the Arup team in those first years. It was his idea, that spherical geometry that allowed them to proceed was his idea. Coming up with that extraordinary construction method of, the rib concrete, precast concrete ribs to create the arches was just amazing. The tile lid system, which was Utzon's design. Yeah, he laboured away on that. And see, unfortunately, when I'm trying to get recognition for Hall, it pushes me into this corner that I don't want to be in, where I'm seen to be criticising Utzon. I don't want to do that. And Utzon himself said, what was it? It's not I that's the problem; it's the building. And he was quite right. You know, it was a the confluence of a design that really wasn't buildable in the first place, so it had to be changed. Utzon, as far as we know, was one of the only architects who placed the halls side by side. So it was a very, very narrow site that imposed constraints on what you could do inside. You know, there were just so many factors that that influenced what happened that, you know, it's... I think it's just wrong to lay the blame with anyone. Maybe we can blame the Sydney Opera House Trust.
Pass it on.
Yes. Sue, down the back.
Should be calling it the Joan Sutherland Theatre, shouldn't we? Yeah.
Just repeat the question.
The question was whether or not the renovations that are happening in the Opera Theatre at the moment are going to make it a much better space. I think they're going to make it a little better. I don't think it's going to create that much more room, as far as I can determine. There'll be a few more seats. The orchestra pit is going to be a bit bigger. But basically, to extend the Opera Theatre, the stage area and the wings, you have to go outside the walls into the foyer area, and they can't do that. And they've toyed with the idea of there's a tie beam that holds the two arches together, and they've toyed with the idea of cutting through that tie beam. This was one of Utzon's plans, and digging down, you know, into the foundations basically to create more space. But last count, that was going to cost $1 billion, so I think that's being abandoned. But the thing is about the Opera Theatre, they've done surveys. People just love going to the Opera House. So the fact that, you know, they're not necessarily getting the grand productions they could in a bigger space
is
irrelevant.
They're not a professional artiste.
No. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be better to leave the Opera House the beauty that it is and have a new Opera House?
No way.
Well, I propose that. Yeah, Ken Woolley was a big supporter of that idea, and putting it sort of nearby in the Botanic Gardens so that you could actually look at the Opera House, the proper one, than the Opera Theatre, but I can't see it happening.
Can I ask the last question? To what extent was it a bit of cultural cringe that this great man from afar who had this brilliant reputation couldn't actually finish it for a lot of the people, couldn't accept that, and that our own little ordinary architect could actually make a contribution? I mean, to me, it's almost like that.
Especially
in that time, we always thought the overseas product was so much better and more sophisticated.
Still do.
Yeah, and how could one of us really match that genius? And so the vitriol and all the sort of clubbishness built up, is that... part of the equation?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think that was a very strong factor, and it's, you know, still around today. I think we've moved on a bit, but you know, it's probably the whole Opera House fiasco. I'd call it a fiasco, but you know, there's that extraordinary building down there that is evidence that maybe it was otherwise. It was worth it. Yep.
Thank you very much. And I think that's it.
Thank you.
I missed the first bit, but I gather this was quite an exceptional night. Anne and Michael, you're leading a charge. We hope that you get to the end of the journey and convert all those sceptics. But I, as someone who grew up in Melbourne with a mother-in-law who's a musician, she cursed the Sydney Opera House for its lack of the detail inside, and we all thought she was raving mad, just a Melbourneian who didn't like Sydney. But she had a point. And it's so good to hear that you've done all this work that'll make us recognise what took place, who really should get the credit, and let's hope that we retell the story again and again. Thank you both.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.